This is a Country Breakfast on RN. I'm Edwina Farley. Let's join our rural reporters. This week we're harvesting and processing a taste of the sea. Not oysters or scallops, but sea urchins. We learn how to get the best out of a metal detector and meet a fellow with a collection of electric fence chargers. You could say it sparks a passion. We'll also step back in time to the Wild West when the Silverado shootout moseys on in to the New South Wales city of Broken Hill.
Some people go full on from gamblers to cowboys to Indians to Mexicans. We've got the lot. It's quite an incredible sight to see when you see 90 blokes and females walking around with chaps and spurs and hats and big dresses. It's good to see.
You'll meet Tumbleweed, Lonesome Dove, Bodie and friends a bit later, but first up today we're off to the south coast of New South Wales, where sea urchins are being harvested and processed.
I'm just cracking them open and passing them over there so they can get the roe out of them. Then the girls clean them up.
How many do you think you've done today?
Oh, how many do you reckon we've done today? I wouldn't have a clue, yeah, a fair bit. Yeah. 45 boxes, if not more, yeah.
Getting to the roe inside this sea urchin isn't easy. The spikes look pretty nasty, but the effort is well worth it for Michael and the team here at this small factory at Pambula in southeastern New South Wales. Are they pretty spiky to touch? Is that why you got gloves on there?
Yeah, yeah. And once they go in your fingers, they don't really want to come out. So they got on the end of them, they got really little spikes. And yeah.
So you got to be careful.
Yeah. That's why we got those big gloves.
Hello, I'm Josh Becker. Keith Brown and Andrew Curtis set up South Coast Sea Urchins just on 10 years ago, supplying the domestic, wholesale and restaurant trade. The roe is especially prized in Asian cuisine, with Chinese and Japanese restaurants paying a premium for the top quality product.
Yeah, it's an unusual shape and character. It's similar to a fish roe in some ways. A lot of people call it caviar of the sea, of course, but the taste is the part. It's how to describe the taste, isn't it? It's a unique taste.
It's like eating the ocean.
Yeah. When I tasted it with people from Melbourne, very similar to a scallop. And when I tested it with people from New South Wales, very similar to an oyster. So if you're in between those two tastes, you're pretty right. So.
Divers harvest the sea urchins from the ocean floor. They have a reputation for being very destructive in the marine environment, their sharp teeth stripping the rocks bare.
I'm just going to show you these. These are their teeth. So this is... That's chomping along the bottom. And if you see that,
that's the mouth there. That's all their teeth sticking out there. And then what we do is that's what we call Aristotle's lantern. So we just knock the lantern out, which makes it easier to remove the roe after that point. But the teeth themselves are quite aggressive. They can eat rock comfortably, graze rock. You can see here, this is a piece of weed that's probably come out from mouth. You can see how they just chomp it like that. And they just feed it in. So they're quite destructive on the bottom. They can eat a large amount of food a day, that's for sure. So that's your roe coming out there.
Yeah.
The idea is to try and not damage the roe too much, because the market we're chasing now is A-grade quality, uni grade, and the more intact it is, the better the market we can produce for it. So this is all the messy part of the operation, all the guts and glory here. As it comes down the line, we just do a rough pick and then a fine pick, and as it gets cleaner and cleaner and cleaner as it comes out, we change the water quite regularly, make up our own salt water, and then we just do a cooling process. Just bring this room here, which we rapidly cool the product down to temperature, get down as cold as we can, as quick as we can.
Keith Brown and fellow diver John Smythe have been using underwater cameras to document how the seabed recovers once the urchins have been harvested and removed from an area.
This footage shows that you're looking now here, and and you'll see abalone in some of these crevasses where we never fished before. So personally, I've watched Keith dive in spots where I abalone dive later, and I'm now getting good catches in a broader area off where he's fished for sea urchin.
This is what it was like right up to where I started the dive when I started 3-4 years ago. So we've now moved that bottom out to about 45, 50 feet of water. And that bottom goes right out to the sand edge, which might be about 110 feet deep. So there's still a lot of potential work to be done here over time. And we find that over each year, the urchins move back into where we work, so we then thin them out and they come back in, thin them out. And every time we thin them out, the bottom gets better and better and better behind them. So, and it allows us to have a bigger fishery, what we're trying to do here. To me, I've noticed a lot of is when we've thinned out, how quickly the abalone move out and replace that area quite fast. And as they move, they spawn and they re-establish more colonies of abalone further out. And the amount of fish life that's now increased is quite noticeable. So we believe by continuing the program for 10, 15 years, I think we'll see a huge biodiversity change here, quite substantial change. So we're looking forward to that, actually. Cool.
So what's the future for South Coast sea urchins? Keith Brown and Andrew Curtis hope to tap into the lucrative export trade. They also see room for expansion in the domestic market.
The taste is there, and I think in years to come, you'll see it in quite a few restaurants and bars in the city all over the place as a snack food or a main meal, or because it can be used for so many purposes, to eat raw, it's on its own, or accompaniment for spaghettis, marinaras or steak, so surf and turf, that sort of ingredient. The chefs themselves in Sydney just love experimenting with it because it's got so many, with the flavour, it really makes the food jump and pop, they call it, and all sorts of things. And it's what happens in a restaurant, they tell me that after everyone's eaten it, it's a talking point. It's it becomes a part of the discussion of the whole table. And that's what they love. You know, it's all about the story, and they love to hear it about it and everything else. So it's really coming good now. So,
yeah, taste.
Yeah, all right, I'll have a taste. Yeah, just get it straight in. It's salty, it's like an oyster, a little bit like an oyster, but a different texture, I think. And, but yeah, you can taste the ocean through it, don't you reckon?
Yeah. So we find a little target here with our detector. And in this test bed, it's all about showing people that are doing our courses that you can't tell the difference between junk and a gold target, and you've got to dig everything.
Ever tried your hand at prospecting, spurred on in the hope of stubbing your toe on a big gold nugget? Well, plenty of people have tried, but few have made their fortune, let alone a living, lugging their metal detectors across the country. One bloke who does, though, is Tony Pilkington. He's a professional prospector living in the gold mining town of Leonora, north of Kalgoorlie in Western Australia. Hello, I'm Tara DeLandgraft, and Tony and his wife Lisa have decided to open a prospecting school, passing on their knowledge to locals and tourists alike. We're out here in your back shed, your HQ, effectively, in Leonora. We're looking over some, as you mentioned, some test pits, really, for students that come along and do a course on how to find gold. You're a prospector. Why did you want to give away your secrets?
Well, it's not really giving away secrets. My wife and I are full-time prospectors, and we've been thinking about doing this for a number of years. And it's all about teaching people the right way to go about prospecting so that they know what their rights and their obligations are, and so that they can find gold consistently and legally and have success. We've had a lot of success prospecting. We love it, and we want other people to have the same sort of success.
So who's coming up and wanting to find gold here in Leonora?
All ages, all demographics. I suppose it sort of leans a bit more towards retired folk, but a lot of people do get the gold bug, and you know, they're chasing the information, and that's obviously where we help.
Where are people going wrong? What are the biggest no-nos that you're correcting people in?
I think it's understanding that metal detectors are just a tool of the trade, and it's a lot more of the basics. It's getting away from computers and getting out in the bush and recognising the signs that are right in front of people. That's what makes them successful.
Is there still gold out there to be found?
Absolutely. I firmly believe that there's more gold in the ground than has ever come out. It's just all the dirt in between that makes it a bit tricky.
Now, in the last 12 months, we've seen quite a decline in the gold price. Luckily, the Aussie dollar's still held up there. Has that influenced the number of people who are interested in prospecting, be it of a weekend or career prospectors such as yourself?
Professional prospectors, yes, because sort of $200 or $300 in the gold price does make a difference when you've got sort of fairly high operating expenses. For the majority of people that are hobby prospectors, look, they're out here for a sense of adventure. They're having a go. It's about the freedom. The gold price is not that relevant. It makes it nicer, you know, if it was up around $20,000 an ounce, but it's not.
You talk about that freedom, and plenty of prospectors I know are rather solitary characters, Tony. So going in and now effectively being a teacher in a classroom to a lot of people, how's that going, that change of mindset?
That's actually the hardest part, because generally prospectors keep to themselves, but we really enjoy people's company, and we find that the people that are doing the courses are great people as well. So it's a pretty easy transition.
Well, as mentioned, prospecting is usually a solitary affair in remote locations. Tony Pilkington says it's important people follow some basic safety rules while out in the bush.
You need good, reliable communications, and you need a plan. You need to let people know where you are, where you're going, and when you're going to be contacting them, and stick to that plan. It's not rocket science.
So why do you do it? Why do you love it?
We like it because it gives us a great link to the bush. It gives us something to do out in the bush, a place where we love to be. It's a great sense of adventure, and it's that sense of freedom. It's also a living, so it's about money as well. Has to be.
Prospector Tony Pilkington on the search for gold with Esperance reporter Tara de Landgraft. Still to come this morning, a shootout in the Silver City and a collection that sparks a passion.
Well, I've got all the old type electric fence charges with a wheel and a clock-like spring. The oldest one I've got here is a 1930. Actually got that from Mundubbera, and we worked out the age of it from... it was given to him for to play with when he was a kid.
When you were a kid, did you ever do that thing where you listened for the clicks along an electric fence line and then tried to grab it before you got the charge? I always got zapped, and for me, that's where the fascination ended. But not so for Kevin Dossel. This avid collector from near Bundaberg in southeastern Queensland has more than 50 antique electric fence charges, some dating back to the early 1900s, in his possession.
Over the years, we've got other ones, brought a few back from New Zealand, and a couple from Sweden, one from America, and this feed right here from New Zealand with the ball bearing on it. It works on the same principle as all these others. It's actually an electric fencer. And up on this top end here, we had got two rows there of homemade ones.
Hello, I'm Callie Buchanan. Rather than leave this unusual collection in the back shed gathering dust, Kev loves nothing more than bringing it out for the public to see and hear, and if they're game enough, have a feel. Today I found him at a field day in Bundaberg, but you could find him at just about any and every Queensland show. The first obvious question, what's the fascination with electric fence chargers?
I don't know. Something else that somebody else hasn't got. Or something somebody else hasn't got, yeah.
So they're making a lot of clicking noises. Can you describe for me how some of these older ones work?
They all work on the same principle, electromagnetism, and when the points hit together, like in the old type cars, that's when the current goes to your spark plug. On these, when the points hit together, that's when the current comes out to your fence. And at the same time, all the points that are being hit are loose, and when they hit together, magnet pulls it back and gives the wheel a bit of a flick back, and then the spring pulls it back into place again.
And that's where you get your charge?
And that's where you get your momentum. The charge is when the points go together, the current goes through the coil and a capacitor, condenser, and out to the fence, yes.
Do they pack a bit of a punch?
Well, some do. Do you want to feel one?
No, not at all.
We got one there. It's only 300 volts. We muck around with kids, only with parents' permission. and every hour or so they come back for a recharge. And it's good fun.
Yeah, you've got some here back to as far as 1930. Were we using electric fences before then?
Yes, definitely have been. Gallagher in New Zealand, we had the opportunity of going through their factory in 2000, and they were coming up to, I think, 85 years then. And so they've had their 100 years thing, and they thought that they might have been the first ones to make electric fences, but they found out a company in America was making them about 4 or 5 years before they started.
And are the modern electric fences similar to some of these older ones that you've got on display?
Yeah, they all put out a boot. But they're all electronic or solid state, no moving parts. And once they, 90% of them, once they stop working, you can't get them working. All the resistors and transistors and capacitors are all moulded in together and you can't just get at them. And so I've got them from, we've got one from South Australia, we've got quite a few from Victoria, New South Wales, and a heck of a lot out of Queensland by going around to the shows and things like that.
As quite a few people have stopped as they've come past to check out what's making the racket. Do you find that people are interested to know more about the history of the electric fence?
The older generation, yes, and the younger generation, but the older generation because they used them and they'd never realised there were so many different types. And the younger generation, because they didn't realise that they had these old ones before the U-Butte, the solid-state ones come out. And a lot of them just didn't realise that they were making them way back in those days.
You're dressing appropriate attire, cowboy attire or cowgirl attire. Everything is pre-1890, so you use 2 6-shooter revolvers, a lever-action rifle and a side-by-side shotgun.
You could be forgiven for thinking you'd stepped back in time to the Wild West, not the Far West, if you were travelling through the New South Wales town of Broken Hill on the weekend. Hundreds of shooters and their posies were dressed up in their best cowboy and saloon gal gear for the Silverado shootout. Hello, I'm Cherie von Hirschner. The sharpshooters are decked out with sidearms, lever-action rifles and shotguns. They fire away at still targets. Speed and accuracy are must if they're to be crowned the Silverado champion, a worthy title when you're competing in the town known as the Silver City. Organiser Cale Grotti, perhaps better known under his alias Bodie, explains the fascination with this growing gun sport.
Some people go full on, from gamblers to cowboys to Indians to Mexicans. We've got the lot. It's quite an incredible sight to see when you see 90 blokes and females walking around with chaps and spurs and hats and big dresses. It's good to see. 5,000 or 6,000 people in Australia that shoot this, and there's about 120,000 in America that shoot it. So it's a huge sport, definitely over there, and it's very popular in Australia also.
Now, it's not just dressing up and having a few potluck shots at a target. How serious is this game, and what is it all about?
Yeah, oh, it's definitely serious. Like, you're shooting for bragging rights. So it's speed and accuracy based. You've got to shoot as quick as possible in the order you're directed over 10 stages. So you can't just blaze away and hope for the best. You do have to have a bit of skill to hit the targets as quick as possible. And this afternoon we had the Master Gunfighter, or Top 16 Shoot-Off. So as the top 16 places, they go into a hat, they get drawn out, they shoot against each other, and it's a knockout situation where, starts at 16, it gets down to 2, they shoot off, and it's normally pretty top quality by the time it gets down to 2.
Now, talking about top shooters, you and your brother are known to be pretty pretty fast.
Yeah, we don't like to brag too much, but we're pretty...
Well, you said it is about bragging rights, didn't you?
we've done pretty good for ourselves over time. I'm currently 6th in Australia, and Ben, also known as Henry Sharps in the shooting game, he's the current Australian champion, and he shot over in America a couple of times and done well in the world titles.
And just lastly, your name, Bodie. How did you come up with that name?
My name is a small western town in America. The town was called Bodie, And it was renowned for being a very violent and wild town back in the early 1800s. And wild, like everyone hears of Tombstone because of the shootout at OK Corral and that. They reckon the town of Bodie was just as fearsome.
Hi, I'm Tumbleweed, and yeah, I'm from down near Victoria, and a little place near Ararat called Elmhurst. I've been shooting for a lot of my life, you know, living off a farm. Grown up with guns, and then my father's always been shooting this sport, and I suppose it was just always my chance to pop in as soon as I could, and yeah, and I've been loving it ever since I've started, and yeah, I've just grown to it, so I love it.
How old are you?
I'm 14, so turning 15 at the end of the year, and yeah, no, it's enjoyable sport, starting at 12, so been shooting it for 2.5 years now, and yeah, I'm loving it.
Now, it's clear that you love it because you were shooting fast before in one of the big competitions, the big events in this competition. Talk me through that a bit.
At the end of this shoot, we actually had a master gunfighter, so the top 16 shooters get into that and they shoot off against each other. It was actually a bit of a surprise. I'd packed the guns away and then my name got read out, and so I thought, oh, great, because I hadn't been shooting my best this weekend. So, I made it in, and that was, just the best thing, to be in there and have everyone looking on you. And the adrenaline just gets going when you start shooting. Oh, everyone's watching you, and it's just fantastic.
Lonesome Dove, been shooting for about 20 years.
You've got a few guns there strapped around your waist, looking pretty mean. What kind of guns are they?
They're 45 Rugers, yeah.
And are they hard to shoot?
No. Only when you get in a top shootout and you get nervous. No, it's great.
Now, you've been doing this for, you've been shooting for 20 years, you said. What got you into shooting?
Mr. Sky, my husband, he was shooting it, and we went to a shoot and I sort of watched it. And, there was some ladies shooting in costume, and of course what else girls like dressing up. So, yeah, and I thought, oh, I'd like to give it a go, and yeah, and that's where it started, and it's been wonderful.
It looks addictive, is it?
It is, yeah, because we get a lot of ladies that don't shoot but their husbands do, and we try and encourage them to dress up and come to the dinner night, and funny enough, they really love it, and then they sort of want to get into it, and yeah, once they do, they really enjoy it.
Now, you're here in Broken Hill, but you're from Sydney. Do you travel around a lot to these competitions?
Yeah, we try to get as many as we can, yeah.
Mr. Sky, what about you? How long have you been shooting for?
Oh, I've been shooting since about pistol shooting since 1990. I was at a gun show in about 1994, and there was a guy from America. He was had videos of single action shooting, and I joined it for life. And then we went down to the first Australian Championships, which was in Adelaide, bought a caravan, and the rest is history. But we've done a lot of miles with this, and, you know, America 9 times, and New Zealand, we shot everywhere. We won plenty of trophies and honours and all that in the last 20-odd years.
What kind of gun do you use?
I use 45s. Everything's 45. That's a man's load. And, you know, there's other smaller loads and stuff like that that they think are quicker. But I like you to listen to the bang.
I'm Ace McKenzie. I've come up from Adelaide, South Australia.
You're looking pretty dapper. How would you describe what you're wearing?
Well, I go for more the town cowboy than the rough and ready out on the range cowboy, which most of the other shooters do so well. My alias came from, I like playing cards and things like that, and I thought so I'd be more the card sharp, so the satin vests and those sorts of things, waistcoats and bowler hats and that sort of thing. The sad thing to admit is I've spent an awful lot more money on my clothes than I would like to admit. But I do figure that if you are not the greatest of shooters, because I'm still quite new, that I should at least put in the effort and try and look the part.
Looking good is all important for Ace McKenzie, dressing up for some gun-smoking action at the Silverado Shootout competition in Broken Hill. And you can see some great photographs of the Ace, Tumbleweed and Lonesome Dove on the website. Check it out at abc.net.au/rural.